You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again in studio by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Hello, Alan.
Oh, it's a bit strong, I think, Castor.
Our science expert. I mean, certainly more expert than either of us, at least in the realm of science.
A supposed expert. There we go. We'll go with that.
Right. Yeah. So what have we got going on this week with Roman wine?
Well, yeah, let's talk wine. it's a good subject. What's the oldest wine that's still in existence? There you go. There's a little question for you.
God, I can't tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Neither could I until last night when I looked this up. But amazingly, there is a bottle of wine that dates from about 325 to 350 CE. So
probably quite good by now.
Well, it's been aged for a while. They found it in the tomb of a Roman couple, so obviously they got buried with their favourite stuff. But here's a question. What did Roman wine taste like? We know that the Romans were into their wines. They've obviously, you know, they live in the right part of the world to have good wine, etc. Yeah. So is there any way that we could possibly know what Roman wine tasted like?
Have a sip.
Yeah, I think that's going to cost you a bit, that one. But so there's a couple of workers in Belgium and Poland sort of asked this question, you know, what can we know about what wine tasted like? Because I think the common maybe conception might be that, oh, you know, they didn't know what they were doing back in those days and blah-de-blah-de, and it probably tasted like vinegar sort of thing. So what these two researchers noticed and have just recently published is that the way that Georgia makes wine is very, very similar to the way that the Romans used to make their wine. So what the Romans did was they used clay pots and these things, or clay jars called dolia. And in Georgia, the historical way of making wine is, again, using these earthenware vessels that they called, and forgive my Georgian is not too crash hot, they're called kvivri.
Right.
And so they sort of thought, okay, well, you know, there's obviously similarities here. So maybe if we, you know, investigate the way that Georgians make their wine and compare it with what we know about Roman wine, et cetera, et cetera. And compare the both, I guess, with the supposed modern ways of making wine. And so one of the big differences to start off with is that, you know, wineries these days generally do their fermentations in metal containers. That's very, very different to the Georgian/Roman way, because they're using earthenware or clay jugs, pots, whatever. And these are porous to air, so air can actually enter during the fermentation process. And they obviously realized this back in the day, the Romans, because what they would do, they would coat the inside of these pots with a resin from pine trees, okay? And the Georgians also do something similar, and they would coat their, or they do coat their pots with beeswax.
Right.
Okay. And for the latter, the beeswax gives a sort of a grassy, nutty, dried fruit flavor. You always talk about, you know, these words that are just totally, you know, incapable of expressing what you're tasting, I think, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
it's always, you know, Sauvignon's always grassy, you know, and you know, cat pee or whatever. But the words just aren't there. You've actually got to taste it for yourself, I guess. But so that is the similarity between the Georgian and the Roman way of making wine. Also, the shape of the container is very, very important as well. And so they both use sort of egg-shaped containers. And that's important because that means that sort of the liquid can mix. You get sort of thermal currents in the liquid and everything. So that can mix. But all of the skins and stuff like that sort of drop to the bottom. And so you're not getting too much contact of the wine itself with, you know, the skins and the seeds and all of those sorts of things that are at the bottom. And so that's generally thought of as being a good thing in terms of the taste of the wine that you get. And then the other thing that they do very similarly is they both bury them in the ground. and this thing gives you temperature control as well. And so they estimated, these workers, they estimated sort of a range of temperatures between about 13 and 28 degrees Celsius, which if you've ever been in Italy in the middle of summer, you know that it definitely gets warmer than 28 degrees Celsius. So, and again, another thing, so we're used to our white wines and our red wines and perhaps a little bit of rosé in the summer, and that's about it. But if you are a little bit au fait with the wine scene, you know that orange wines are a bit of a thing now. And that seems to be what these Roman ones and certainly the Georgian ones are as well, because of the fact that in these pots the liquid is coming in contact with the skin, so you're getting slight sort of maceration, and that then gives you a distinct sort of orange colour. And what you then also get from the fact that you've buried these and you've coated them in beeswax, etc., 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 is a thick white foam on the top during fermentation, and this also gives a barrier to contact with oxygen from the air as well. And it also gives a spicy taste, and this is due to yeast on the surface of the wine. And so you get this sort of toast and apples and roasted nuts and, of all things, curry, apparently. Mm. So so if you ever wanted to know what Roman wine tastes like, I guess the moral of the story is go and buy a bottle of Georgian wine, and you've probably got a fair idea.
It's close enough.
Well, it's certainly similar anyway. You know, the methods are similar. But, you know, even the similar methods for a particular grape can just yield ridiculously differently tasting things anyway. But, I mean, the poor old Romans, I mean, it wasn't the making of the wine, it was the storing of the wine that apparently led to their downfall, because they kept it in bloody lead amphoras and they all died of lead poisoning.
Foolish.
I know. Mm. So be careful in what you store your wine, folks.
Yeah, nobody at home use lead bottles to store your wine.
No.
Or anything.
Definitely not. Yes.
All right, moving on to dating this solar flare.
Absolutely. So 1859, we go back to now, so slightly forward of the Roman times, and we go to a thing called the Carrington event, which is a very, very funny, I know. See, it's so impressive, it's got its own name. So the Carrington event was the strongest solar flare that has been recorded, I guess, in modern history. And how do we know that it occurred? It occurred because we get all of these aurora, borealis, et cetera, occurring. So, you know, solar storms and just aurora everywhere, and so this made obviously a real impact, and it was recorded down. They obviously didn't know what it was at that stage, and in addition to all these aurora, they also got lots of interference with the telegraph system, which was sort of a relatively new invention at that stage. And so there's lots of documentation of this particular event, but where is the physical evidence that it ever happened? Because, you know, supposedly all that we've got are the aurorae, and, you know, they were seen by lots and lots of people. So some workers in Finland thought, right, well, you know, might there be any physical evidence that we've been overlooking for the past 200 nearly years or 150 or so years? And so what they did was that they decided to look in trees, which is normally a good place to look for anything.
Squirrels.
In addition, yes, yeah. Yes. And so what they did was they went up to Lapland, and they went up above the Arctic Circle, and they sort of went what they call their mid-latitudes, which we would call probably a long way north, but not as far north as the Arctic Circle. And they started looking at trees there. And what they were looking for is carbon-14. Okay, so carbon-14 is a radioactive form of carbon. Now, usually it's formed by solar particles or cosmic rays, okay, which are coming from all directions, etc., etc., and hit molecules in the atmosphere and essentially ends up converting nitrogen to carbon-14 in a process we won't go on about. So we've got this background amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere, and that gets incorporated into everything living. So you, me, everybody has got some radioactive carbon-14 in it as a result of ingestion through this particular process in the atmosphere. Now, we get a solar flare. These are charged particles, so they differ in that sense from cosmic rays. Now, charged particles, so they're coming from the sun. So a solar flare is basically the sun burping, basically. It's just a big expulsion of energy and these massive charged particles. And away they go, and they head towards Earth. And as soon as they come into contact with our magnetic field, then what happens is they get deflected up to the poles. Okay, so they go up, they go down. They don't come in at the equator or anything like that. And then when they hit the atmosphere, they also undergo this similar sort of reaction with molecules in the atmosphere, and that forms carbon-14, which is in addition to the amount of carbon-14 that you just get from normal cosmic rays. So these folk reckon that, okay, possibly what we should see is an increase in the amount of carbon-14 in 1859 in trees that are a long way north. Mm. And you think, how do you know it's 1859 in a tree? Easy, count the rings.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so that's what they did. They went right up above the Arctic Circle, and they had a look at some trees there, looking at 1859 and measuring the C14 there, which is easy to do. You're just, you know, Geiger counter or whatever, or, you know, a more sensitive technique, but it's a relatively easy thing to do. And lo and behold, that's what they found. They found that in the trees that were above the Arctic Circle, very, very, very far north, they found in 1859 a distinct blip in the amount of carbon-14, which is basically signature evidence of the fact that this Carrington event had occurred, and the C14 that was produced in that had been incorporated in living material. And they didn't see this in the trees at lower latitude, which I think is really, really rather cool. And now what humanity does know is there were similar events in the years 1582, 1730 and 1770. So that's these guys' next thing, is to go and look for physical evidence that they occurred. So very, very, that's elegant stuff, I reckon. Very, very nice.
Yeah, always nice to find proof for something. You know, there's this evidence around to suggest it might have happened.
Yes, and absolutely. Then, and now they've got, yeah,
now it's concrete proof.
Absolutely.
And then lastly, we've got here the brightest cosmic blast.
Absolutely. Cool. Okay, it's the brightest of all time, or the boat.
Right.
And that is what they're calling it. It's not Nathan Lyon. It's, yes, the brightest gamma ray burst of all time. Mm. And this actually occurred a couple of years ago, 2022, and this was picked up by the James Webb Telescope, which was basically sent up to, you know, find all of these sorts of things. And so what it saw, basically, was an extraordinarily bright event. And what they thought was, oh, gosh, you know, what's this? This is probably a supernova, probably, but it's really, really, really bright. So we need to sort of investigate this because it could be sort of out of the ordinary. And it was so bright that basically for 6 months they couldn't look at it. It's like looking straight at the sun, yeah, sort of thing. So right. They couldn't really see anything because the radiation coming out was just too bright. So after 6 months it had died down a bit, and then they were able to look at it and see that it was just basically a bog standard supernova. And a supernova occurs essentially when you've got a sun that is in its last stages of life, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then sort of basically collapses onto itself and releases like eye-watering amounts of energy. But this one wasn't sort of anything out of the ordinary, really, from what they could see. It was just seemingly a bog-standard supernova, and they're not quite sure why it was so bright. They think that maybe the radiation might have been focused in one particular direction. We were just lucky to be sort of sitting in that particular direction, so it appeared very, very bright to us. But what they're really interested in is, well, we've got all the elements on the periodic table. We know how the elements 1 to 26 basically are formed. So hydrogen to iron, yep. We know how they're formed. Anything heavier than that, we don't know how they're formed. And it's proposed that they're formed through these types of events, through collapse of a star onto itself and supernova events, because they've got the energies required to do these sorts of things, essentially. So what they were looking for, in addition to, you know, what is this, they were also looking for presence of things like gold, platinum, all of these heavy elements, and they didn't find any.
Ooh.
And this is sort of their supposition at the moment, that basically that's the way that these heavy elements are formed. And now, thanks to the boat, they might have to go back and rethink how all of this works. So this is another one of those, you know, stay tuned, and see what happens. Stories. Right.
It's almost like, how, I guess they've been running with this hypothesis for a while.
Yes, indeed they have. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
And then now.
And now they're going to have to look for another hypothesis, really, because it looks like, you know, very possibly this is not the way that the heavy elements were formed or are formed. So, yeah.
Not a great way to be proven wrong either by the boat.
The boat.
Just a little bit embarrassing, I guess. All right. Thank you for coming on today. Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Moshe. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.